Good morning, comrades. This is Jeff on WHIV LP New Orleans 102.3. This show is called Good Morning, Comrade. You can listen every Tuesday at 8 a.m. And you can also check us out online at whivfm.org/good-morning-comrade and get more information at goodmorningcomrade.com. Today on the line, we have Kenzo Shibata. Kenzo is a teacher. He's also a member of the Chicago Teachers Union and Democratic Socialist America. How you doing, Kenzo?
Good. How are you doing, Jeff?
Doing all right. Just
thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. This is actually going to release on Mardi Gras.
Nice.
So it's going to be like one of those interesting. Did you ever been to Mardi Gras?
I've been to New Orleans, but never on Mardi Gras.
Yeah,
I would love to, but haven't.
Yeah, it was. We actually went out to the. I'm sitting at home right now in my home studio, but we did go to parades yesterday and had a good little time. I actually wore like one of those Barbie Bernie shirts. It was
uh-huh. Kind of, nice.
Got a lot of you know, pats on the back for that. So that was pretty cool.
So did you have today off for President's Day?
No, we get the whole week off for Mardi Gras.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah, we get a week off for Mardi Gras. I think we just get like a shorter spring break than most places do. This is a teacher show. I love it. It's great.
Yeah, we had Lincoln's birthday off because we're at the state of Illinois. We had that last week.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
Much needed. Needed yeah. to take a little break. Love my children, but needed a break from them for a few days.
Yeah, exactly. And so you teach civics?
I teach, yeah, civics and a Chicago history class in CPS.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Civics is like the most fun time to be teaching civics.
Yeah, because like president stuff and there's like, there's always stuff going on in Chicago, it seems.
Yeah, and the kids are really into it. Like, as long as I'm bridging like whatever concepts I'm teaching in class to, you know, current events during the election, like they're really into it.
Right, yeah.
We did a caucus in class, and we did several different. We did ranked choice voting, and we did just a regular ballot, and the kids were just really interested in looking at the data. Bernie won. Like across the board,
nice.
in every class, and I'm, you know, I consider myself not to be a biased teacher. I just present facts, and you know, we have discussions, and kids love Bernie.
Sure, yeah. I mean, he talks to people in a lot of ways, kind of like hits them where they're at. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's really kind of cool. Yeah, and what grade do you teach him?
The civics class is 11th grade.
Okay.
Some of the CPS schools teach it freshman year. We thankfully teach it junior year. I think that's the right maturity level for the kids.
Right before a lot of them turn 18, where they would
yes.
be able to vote. And I mean, you can get them thinking about it on that. Like that's a good time to get them thinking about that kind of stuff.
And like with a lot of my kids, like as long as they turn 18 by the time of the general, they can vote in the primaries in Illinois
yeah.
at 17. So, yeah. I'm, you know, we're getting all the kids registered and they're excited about it. Like they're really excited about the fact that we're finally after like, you know, a decade of doing simulations in class, they actually can go out and vote.
Right.
And, yeah. I'm stoked. They're stoked about it.
Yeah. That's good. It's good. Good seeing kids get plugged in and stuff like that. And so I met you initially, during the Chicago teacher strike. A couple of friends of mine from New Orleans kind of did the flight up, and you and me and Eric Blanc and some other mm-hmm. folks had lunch or dinner. So I guess we could talk a little bit about the teacher strike that took place. Would you like to kind of set it up for kind of like the run up to it and then kind of like what happened during it and then maybe some of the aftermath?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the Chicago Teachers Union went on an 11-day strike just a couple months ago. It ended the end of October. Halloween was the last day, actually.
Yeah.
And it started because we got this new mayor in Chicago. We had a very terrible mayor before her. We had Rahm Emanuel, who, you know, forced us into our first strike in 25 years just because he was just so awful and wanted to cut back so much. He actually closed 50 schools during his tenure in 1 year when he was mayor. Mm-hmm. Not a very pro public schools kind of guy.
Uh-huh.
And so we had a mayoral election come up for the first time in, you know, a while, we had the incumbent decide not to run again. So Rahm Emanuel didn't run again, and it was kind of an open field. We had what seemed like 30 candidates at first running, and it all narrowed down to two choices in the final election because it went into a runoff. Tony Preckwinkel, who's the president of our Cook County board, mm-hmm. and Lori Lightfoot, not the mayor at the time, who is a corporate lawyer with Mayor Brown, also was a prosecutor.
And a prosecutor. Oh, yes. 2-1.
Union busting lawyer and cop.
Oh, my God.
And we talk about Larry Krasner. We talk about Kim Fox. There are prosecutors doing good and interesting things. She is the opposite of that.
Right. Yeah. She's doing bad things, terrible things.
She is like the typical prosecutor, you know, we need to be tough on criminals, we need to be tough on crime kind of person. But anyway, yeah, the two of them were in the runoff. Tony Preckwinkel has some baggage, I would say. I personally supported her. The CTU endorsed her. And the problem, though, is that she was closely linked to a lot of members of the Chicago Machine, some of whom have been recently indicted. And that was used against her. And then I think another big nail in her coffin, and you know, I want Mike Bloomberg to know this too, is she imposed a soda pop tax in Chicago, which made her extremely unpopular. Mm-hmm. That was something that hit, you know, rich people, poor people, working people, everyone, you know, drinks. We call it pop. Even like a lot of the kind that was not sweetened. And even though it was considered a sweetened beverage tax, were taxed. So people were really upset about that.
They taxed
eventually. I'm sorry?
They taxed in LaCroix?
Yeah, initially they were. And they had to like do some sort of they had to like clean up the bill or something, so they weren't taxing LaCroix. And, like,
instead of taxing the wealthy, just tax the soda, you know?
I mean, that would have been a great way to make Chicago DSA bankrupt, is to like tax our LaCroix.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Get enough of that. Yeah. It's a Midwestern thing. But anyway, yeah, that was something that was used against her. And Lori Lightfoot, who no one really knew anything about, won in this landslide. And she was extremely upset that the union, the CTU, didn't endorse her. And the fact that we were pretty critical of her for good reason. Right. So in some ways, it seemed very personal that she forced us out on this strike. She wouldn't talk about any of the issues that we had at the table, like decreasing class sizes, increasing the number of aides for special education classes, having additional supports for students with temporary living situations. Mm. She just didn't want to talk about anything but the bread and butter issues, which is not kind of like not the way CTU really rolls. Like, we really want to improve the lives of our students in each contract.
Now, can you just stop for 1 second, just mm-hmm. sort of explain a little bit of how Chicago Teachers Union does roll, and then we can move on from there.
So, you know, from the time we started, you know, we've always linked up with community organizations and also just directly with the communities in our schools.
When you say we, you mean the Caucus of Rank and File Educators?
Yes. Yeah, I should back up a little bit more, maybe. In 2010, a radical militant group of teachers took over the Chicago Teachers Union. We're core, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators. Uh-huh. We essentially formed because we had a union leadership at the time that was not fighting school closings. And that was a huge problem. It's still an ongoing problem in Chicago, where programs are cut, charter schools are opened, and then public schools are closed. Mm-hmm. And we just felt like the union leadership wasn't doing enough about it. We tried working with them to become a more fighting union. That didn't work. So then eventually we ran for office. And then that was the election year that Karen Lewis won. We defeated them. And CORE has been in office ever since. And that was part of CORE's praxis, really going into it, was, you know, there's no real separation between us, the educators, and the communities that we work with, that we're all same struggle, same demands. And, you know, Rahm Emanuel hated it. We ended up getting a few wins from him out of it. And then with Lori Lightfoot, she was just like, absolutely not. You know, she wanted this contract negotiation. Sorry?
Trying to show you who's boss, right? Like when she steps in, trying to set the tone.
And really, like, so she basically forced us into a strike. It was 0 hour, and we still didn't have a contract. One thing that was really cool was that during the strike vote, that actually the night before we, you know, we started voting, Bernie Sanders came to town and he gave a pep talk to our bargaining team. He gave a pep talk to a bunch of members who showed up as a big rally, and really kind of gassed us up to take that strike vote the next day and got us really excited about the idea of fighting for things that we need. Yeah. And he's been a great ally, you know, throughout this whole process. But then, yeah, we took the strike vote. We get overwhelming. It was about 97% voted yes on authorizing a strike. And then when contract negotiations really broke down, we had to go out for 11 days. Mm-hmm. And it was this was an interesting strike. It was a rough strike. We won a lot. You know, we won for the first time some hard class size caps. Mm-hmm. That require schools to actually hire more adults if we have more kids. We have counselors now can actually do counseling work. They're not just doing, you know, they're not pulled away doing test prep and things like that. Yeah. And then with those funds for the schools that have the high number of students in temporary living situations, like homeless students, that was huge too, because this was the first time we sat across the table from the Chicago Board of Education, and they had to admit that not all schools were the same, that some schools have, you know, children living in abject poverty. And then we do have some schools of like upper middle class and even rich kids too. And they all do require different supports. So we actually were able to talk about equity and not just equality here. Like, it's not good enough to have all the schools have the same resources. We need, some schools actually do need those additional resources.
Right.
So we've,
people where they're at. That's based like a core component of education, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So we won a lot. We didn't win everything that was on the table. We tried getting a little more planning time for elementary school teachers who currently have none, which is really horrendous. They basically have to like enter the school with the kids, and they teach until the end of the day. They get a short lunch, and that's it.
Holy, y'all don't get. Wow, I don't know what I would do without my planning time. Like, even if I wasn't doing planning, I would just go insane. Like, you know what I mean? I need a minute to just kind of like breathe out. You know what I mean?
And that's why, like, a lot of our elementary school teachers, they have bladder conditions. They can't.
Yeah.
You know, as a high school teacher, I can always find someone else in the hallway, another teacher, like, hey, can you watch my class for a few minutes while I go? Like, elementary school teachers don't really have that.
Yeah, I'm lucky because I have a para. I teach special ed. Uh-huh. Era, so like we can switch out, and that's sort of like how it works. But yeah, that is wild that there's no bathroom breaks in elementary school.
Yeah, what grade do you teach?
I teach fourth and fifth grade special education.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's like a generic sort of thing. Like a lot of kids with you know, dyslexia or like emotional disabilities or stuff like that, or ones that have, you know, behavioral issues. But nothing that would be like alternate curriculum or anything like that.
What are your class sizes like?
So I have right now the most I could have is 16 with a para. The problem is I get multiple grade levels, which makes it very difficult to sort of like do the teaching, because they want us to do like they do want like same curriculum like for the grade levels. Mm-hmm. But when I'm doing that with multiple groups in there at a time, it becomes extremely difficult to manage that. And then it's just the whole thing. And I've been like trying to, you know, explain things like that out a bit more. And it just hasn't fell on any friendly ears, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's just pause right now for station ID. You're listening to WHIV LP New Orleans. The show is Good Morning Comrade. My name is Jeff Barawa, and I have Kenzo Shibata on the line, calling in from Chicago. We were talking a little bit about Chicago Teachers Union and the strike that they just went on in October of last year.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the really cool things that I noticed when I was up there, two of the biggest ones, was that there were a lot of folks that were there in support from the community. I met up with Abby. And she was sort of like my main guide for most of the time. And she actually brought myself, Blanca and Michael and Alec and all the folks that were with us. She brought us to the UE Hall, where we made lunches for the kids for the mm-hmm. program, which was really, really cool. You know, we were just packing. We packed about, you know, 200 or something lunches in about, you know, 15 minutes. And that bread program is something y'all fundraised for like through the Chicago ESA, yes?
Yeah, so that was – I was extremely floored by that one. like the idea started actually with the East Bay DSA. They did a Bread for Ed program when Oakland teachers went on strike a while ago, wildly successful. And we just decided that we do the same thing. So the Chicago DSA labor branch worked together with our Chicago Jobs with Justice chapter to organize the whole thing. Yeah. And you know, Abby put together a link, a fundraising link. We shared it online. And then, you know, within days, we had, I think, $25,000 to $30,000 within a couple of days. It got to the point where, like, we had to pause donations for a while because we just could not keep up with, you know, producing the sandwiches. And, like, you know, I guess there was some, you know, weren't sure exactly how long the strike would go. We didn't want, you know, just to fundraise money and then just have it sit there. So they paused it for a little bit. And then something happened during negotiations. I forgot what it was, but there was something where it was obvious that the strike was not going to slow down anytime soon, that they reopened the link. Actually, what was really funny was I went on Chapo Trap House to talk about the strike, and I mentioned Bread for Ed and the link and everything, and we raised like 20 grand in a few hours. Nice. Off of that. So yeah, just we're just plugging it away. And then, you know, the whole idea, I mean, the Chicago Democratic Socialists of America labor branch really had this they had a theory behind everything they were doing. This was something that took some time to think about, but the idea was it was not about directing the political leadership of what the union does or about trying to advise it, but their role was going to be to allow the strike to be as long as it could be and to have the weight on that's falling on the shoulders of the community be kind of as light as possible. Right. So the idea was, okay, then we'll feed kids, we'll feed teachers. And that was so cool that that was such a successful program.
And most kids get their food, like their, maybe their only hot meal of the day might be lunch in school. And I actually wanted to touch on another point of that. That's really kind of cool that when you start to have that community support and you're able to show that you're able to keep that strike rolling for longer, that gives you a lot of leverage over the school district and the mayor.
Definitely. Yes.
Which is brilliant. That's really cool. I like that.
And the one counter though, that the principal or the, I keep saying principal, the mayor had in the situation, was that, she was insisting that she wasn't going to let us make up the days that we were out. Like typically in education strikes, the days are made up at the end of the year because the kids can't lose on education. And the mayor kept saying, you know, we're not going to make up any of those days. We're not going to make up any of those days, which is ridiculous. Like I've worked on strike. I was a former union staffer. Worked on dozens of strikes. It's like a given because the superintendent of a district wants the kids to be in school. Like they want to make the parents happy. They want to make the state happy. And they know that we're providing a good service for these kids.
Right.
And the mayor she took it very much like a prosecutor or a corporate lawyer. And she's like, no, you're not gonna take this time off of work and then get it back at the end or something like that. And it was a really nasty, nasty fight. In the end, she relented and we were out on strike for 11 days and we're making up 5 of them. She poured some salt on that too by like having us make up days that were originally vacation days, which upset a lot of parents. But one of the things that really occurred to me is that, you know, it's critical that teachers, when they go on strike, or educators, when they go on strike, they make up their days, because otherwise there's no incentive for the superintendent or the mayor to keep us out on strike as long as possible. Like she was making, you know, she was basically saying, she's not going to lose anything monetarily. In fact, they gained quite a bit because if we lost 6 days and 25,000 employees, that's quite a bit of money that went millions of dollars that the district is not paying. So that's something that I'm that's the gospel I'm trying to spread as much as possible, is fight for those days back.
Get them days back. And really, so in my state, Louisiana, people always talk about, they talk about like, oh, it's a shame we can't go on strike with people like Chicago or whatever, because like people in Chicago or whatever, because we can't afford it. And to that point right there is like, yeah, you need to get those days back. You need to make sure that is all part of the deal and part of the plan from the beginning.
Yeah. And then also on top of that, just saving. You know, I've been saving for a few years because, you know, if you have like a 5-year contract, put away, you know, even 5%, just a little bit per paycheck over the course of those 5 years, so you're not unprepared at the end, because it could happen.
Right. And like any kind of like a strike fund or whatever for Chicago Teachers Union would be so huge. I did want to also talk a little bit about your partner in crime in this strike, the SEIU.
Yes.
The SEIU local. Now, they were on strike in solidarity, and it was sort of like it was a combination Chicago Teachers Union and SEIU local. Oh, gosh. I'm 73. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. So Local 73 was, and I have no qualms of saying this, like it was known as being a corrupt local. No. It's, you know, the public sector SEIU local in the area. They got under trusteeship a few years ago. Uh-huh. And ever since then, they've had a different direction. And the direction was really organizing. So they've been doing a lot of organizing over the past couple of years, and it really started to pay off. Like if you look at in 2012, when we went on strike, Local 73 under its old leadership, they crossed the picket lines when we went out. There was this was 2012.
Oh, 2012, the first time the most recent time.
The
Caucus of Ranked Adult Educators took over.
Yeah, that was like the first strike in 25 years.
Yeah.
We had no unity with the other unions. We were working towards that at that time. We were only in office for 2 years at that point.
Right.
And, 73, I guess, didn't see that we had the leverage or whatnot. Miscalculation. But so they crossed the line. We made sure that, like, there wasn't any nastiness around it, though. Like, you know, there was no yelling scabs or anything like that at those workers. Like, a lot of those workers felt really bad, to be honest. And those are our special ed classroom assistants, bus aides. They actually, there are quite a few jobs that 73 represents. And they were, so they crossed the line. And in the last few years, like there has been a lot of effort made for us to work together. And luckily we're able to make it work out where we all went on strike together this time, even though we're under two different contracts.
Right.
And they were severely underpaid. Many were making under poverty wages.
Right.
Awful working conditions. They had a really terrible contract. And by going out with us this time around, walking out with us, they had like the richest contract in the history of that local.
Oh, that's great.
Huge strides made in pay benefits. Like even though the CTU, our primary concern wasn't paying benefits for ourselves, we know that our aides and our paras like are making, poverty wages. So we did fight to make sure that they were getting paid, a fair wage or close to a fair wage. And what was really cool about it was, after they had won that, they settled before we did. They stayed out a few more days, even after they settled, to stay out with us. So our strikes actually completely lined up, and it was beautiful. Like you see it in the schools too. Like on the line, we had red and we had red the CTU color, purple the SEIU color, all together singing songs. In my school, we had disco lines, what do they call them, soul train lines.
Some of those videos were great.
It was a good time, and like everyone was together. And when we walked back into school, the strike was over, like I feel like we're all more united now. There are less of the divisions of like who's a para, who's a teacher, who's an aide. Like we're all just kind of in it for the kids, and that part of that experience was really beautiful. And it really does show you like the power of having that solidarity.
Yeah, exactly. Like both groups benefited by working together. I mean, it's that simple. It's just both groups work together, both benefit more. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. One last thing on this and then we can move on. I just wanted to talk about, I was able to make it to one of the marches during that strike. And it was on that Friday, the day that I arrived in town. The strike started on a Thursday, I believe. And it was just unbelievable. I'd never seen that many people marching before. It was,
this is the downtown march.
Yeah. Downtown. Like Marvin drove me all the way down to the, all the way down. It's just cause it's just like, I wanted to check it out. It was too late for the pickets after I'd flown in. So he kind of like brought us down there. We checked it out and it was amazing. It was a gigantic amount of people that were out there.
That was twice as big as our biggest rally in 2012.
Yeah.
Like this was, we kept anticipating this was going to be a bigger event than 2012, and it definitely delivered.
It was.
You know, there was the fear, like in 2012, that like some of that community support we had may have waned, but it actually increased. And, you know, I think a lot of that is also attributed to the fact that we have this newly invigorated left in Chicago and all over the country, really. Like, you know, in 2012, we didn't have the DSA doing Bread for Ed. We didn't have them turning people out. Like, the DSA out here in Chicago, like, adopted 11 strike lines where there would be doing education, bringing out food, bringing out support of any kind they need. And that was really successful. And we're going to definitely, if there's, you know, the next time we do some sort of strike support, we're going to expand upon that. But that was something that didn't happen, you know, in 2012. And, you know, we have a lot of independent, we have six socialist aldermen now that all signed onto a letter saying they unequivocally support the CTU. Of those six, I'm sorry?
What's an alderman?
Oh, good. Good question. Alderman is our, we have a city council structure in Chicago, and each, we have 50 wards, and each ward has one city council member, and they, you know, make sure that the trash is picked up, that the streets are sweeped. They also pass citywide legislation, and they're traditionally, because the Chicago machine model, like they had fiefdoms.
Yeah.
And these six aldermen actually knocked a bunch of oligarchs, or, you know, mini oligarchs, out of their fiefdoms. You know, we had like Rosana Rodriguez, who defeated Rod Blagojevich's sister-in-law, which was a part of the story that didn't come out too much, but yeah, Deb Mel's brother-in-law is Rod Blagojevich. And, you know, just to show you like an example of how that worked.
Wow. And you said the aldermen were a part of pushing support for this as well.
So like those six socialist aldermen, they talked to their colleagues. So we had, I want to say 33 out of 50 aldermen supporting the strike.
That's
huge, because in 2012, we had like none. I mean, we probably had about 33 signing a letter telling us to go back to work. They were most of the aldermen were pretty anti-CTU 8 years ago.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess when you have, and this sort of kind of can like tip, kind of like pivot us towards an electoral thing, but when you have people that are involved and on the inside and who are a part of, you know, that world, then they can actually have like develop influence in that world and start organizing that space. And it's really interesting.
It's a weird time to be alive.
It is. Be alive, like in America, as a leftist person, right?
Yeah, I mean, you saw the Nevada caucus. I'm like, what reality are we in right now? This is amazing.
Yeah, Bernie just on the other side of Station ID, we'll talk about that. You were listening to WHIVLP New Orleans 102.3. This is Good Morning Comrade, Jeff Barawa, and Kenzo Shibata talking about. Well, we're about to start talking about something new. We're going to talk about the caucuses that took place in Nevada. What happened in those caucuses, Kenzo?
Well, Bernie, not only did Bernie win, but I believe he got more votes than everyone else combined.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
It was one of those things where, like, you knew he was going to probably do really well, but you had no idea he was going to be this good.
And then, you know, when they broke it down, like, from the polling, like, you know, when it comes to people of color, he's like far beyond any other candidates.
Right.
Like, he just blows everyone else under the, everything, every negative message, it seems, that's been used against him for the past few months has been the opposite. Like, all of his weaknesses are actually his strengths.
Yeah. And this is another one of those things that it's sort of like weird to the U.S. system in terms of how it like does the primaries even.
Mm-hmm.
But the first state that was less than 90% white people in this primary process was just Nevada. You know, it's like, and the first two he won, but it was very close. And then this one, which has a large non-white population, large Latino population, large like black population, and many others. Those are the people that support Bernie Sanders, it seems like.
Yeah, and that was like the opposite of Warren and Biden's message. Both of them were saying, well, let's just wait till we go to a state that has people of color. And then they did, and Bernie just sweep the floor with everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, that was a really interesting run up to that one as well, because there was some, and I'd like to like pick your brain on this as well, but the Culinary Union, they kind of were doing some things where they would say they couldn't support Bernie Sanders, or were talking about Medicare for All specifically, which is one of his like unique planks just for him. Maybe to a lesser extent, Warren, but that might be being generous. But the Culinary Union essentially came out and they said that Bernie, like the Medicare for All would be taking away union insurance. Mm-hmm. And I get really nervous when a union makes a very sort of venal decision like that.
Yeah.
You have to be. And I don't want to when I see people posting about like unions online, I know I'm going to see people saying the established unions are trash or whatever, and we just have to do our own thing. And it's like, hold on a second. You know, I just get really, really freaked out by that.
No, I hear you on that. Like there's the discourse around a lot of that the past few days, also with the Young Turks staff trying to organize now and getting such resistance from their management. Yeah. It's like mask off for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I said they just got to recognize over there.
Yeah.
On now.
But like just the confusion around that, because like, yeah, there are these bloated bureaucracies with awful leaders that need to be voted out. But at the same time, we also have to support the union, and, you know, kind of conflating the two is, you know, like you're saying, it makes me nervous as well. Like, I think that, you know, it's definitely something that's very indicative of what a lot of top-down union leaders would do, is like, even though they don't want to just trash Bernie Sanders or say, oh no, we're going to, you know, top down, we're going to endorse this person, they'll do it by attacking policies. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what's offensive about this particular one was the fact that this is a policy that's going to save lives, millions of lives. It's something that's, and it's just so disingenuous, because Bernie's labor plan plus his Medicare for All plan is just brilliant. It's only going to help union members. Like, if we negotiate contracts that have health benefits in them, well, we get Medicare for All now, and that money's going to go into our pockets.
Right.
Like, that's only a good thing. And it's really infuriating when you have like top down union leaders trying to sully the water that way, you know, in service of an election. So like, you know, and I think that, you know, what we saw is probably the rank and file voted for Bernie.
Yeah.
You know, if he won by such wide margins, and we know that, you know, he won because of working class voters.
Right. Who are in that union. That's a very working class union.
Yes. So, you know, it didn't seem to impact them too much, but it did create this this awful discourse. And I did see a lot of liberal types and, you know, anti-Bernie types glomming onto that, people who would never stand up for a union in a million years, you know, attacking Bernie supporters for being anti-union. Absolutely infuriating.
See, the Culinary Union did that too. They did like one of these, like the Bernie Bros are in our Menchies sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right.
But yeah, it was one of these. And again, this is one of the things that I like really try to get like clear, like across very clearly on this show, is that like unions are at the end of the day, they're legally required. They're fundamentally democratic entities, right?
Uh-huh.
If they stepped out of line, if they didn't follow through if a union just decided to not follow the law and not be democratic or whatever, you don't think the state would come down and crush it immediately? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the labor boards are waiting for that. You know, they're all appointed by Republicans.
Exactly. We have to understand when we're talking to folks that, you know, might be an engaged member of their union, or they might not have a union at all, that at the end of the day, this is a fundamentally a must be a democratic situation. Otherwise, we need to make it one, right?
Yeah, because the National Right to Work and all those folks, their message is that, you know, these unions, all they do is extract your dues, and like we have to make sure that, you know, National Right to Work is wrong on that, because I mean that's the thing that is one of the big challenges, is that when, you know, you have right wingers pushing out a message that some of our leaders actually do represent in a way, it hurts us. You know, like Randy Weingarten, you know, the head of the or the president of the AFT, you know, she put out that piece in Politico about how Medicare for All is bad for union members. And I mean, part of it too is like she does have a beef with the nurses union. There's always pettiness behind that.
Yeah, a lot of this is beef, like personal beef too.
There's some beef within the culinary union piece too that I don't know enough about to actually like commit words and put them out to the world.
Yeah, of course.
But I've heard things, and you know, it really is sick because sometimes these things can come down to like, you know, tinkling matches.
Right, exactly. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is true. That is very true. Now I did when that Randy Weingarten thing happened, and she talked about it on Greta Van Susteren's show. Uh-huh. We talked about that on this show, but like when you see the leader of a national union, your union, we're in the same union. When you see somebody like that in the national level, like you cannot help saying like to a question about Medicare for All, like, oh, this is actually bad for union members, mm-hmm. which, by the way, it's not bad for union members. Like I still have copays. I have union negotiated insurance, still have copays, still have deductibles, all the bad stuff. It wouldn't be there with Medicare for All. But like when you see her on there saying this complete BS, you know, what goes through your mind?
Well, one of the things that, you know, upsets, because Randy actually knows me. And like, I've told her my story. Like, so my wife has breast cancer. And we were in two situations where we had like gaps. One of them was a possible gap of insurance. And the other one was we had a gap in insurance for a few days. And those were like couple of the most traumatic days of my life, or, you know, experiences of my life, when all that happened. And, you know, I was explaining it to Randy very, you know, clearly, like if we had Medicare for All, I wouldn't have to worry about that. You know, I would switch jobs or I would switch coverage and we would be okay. And, you know, she has no answer for that. But, you know, it's like, you know, even if we do have negotiated insurance, you know, it's a better deal to never have that gap. Like my issue was, one of them was I literally put the wrong cover letter on a fax that I sent out. And yes, I had actually sent out a fax to this company. And the other one was, it was actually fear during the strike. I was afraid that one of the things that Mayor Lightfoot was using against us was the fact that had we struck into November, they were going to cancel our insurance.
Oh my God.
So that was something that was weighing really heavily on me too. And I explained that to her too. Like it only will benefit unions if we can go on strike and not fear losing our insurance. Like I could save up money and then eat canned beans for a few days. Yeah. But I cannot afford healthcare out of pocket.
Exactly. Nobody can. It's so expensive.
Yes.
But that's one of the things that happened with the United Auto Workers and the GM strike. The CEO came out initially and he said, I'm going to cancel your insurance. And then he ended up, due to public pressure, not doing that. But
yeah,
it's sorts of things where when you're like, I like to talk about this. It takes one huge, like critical component of things that you are negotiating for all the time and you can't ignore, takes it off entirely. So from a union's perspective, you can actually bargain for things like pay or working conditions or in education situation, learning conditions for children.
Uh-huh.
So Medicare for All helps unions so much.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like this must be like a side thing, but like it's a very common thing in the Chicago public schools during lunch where you'll be in a teacher's lounge and everyone will have their phones out playing hold music because they're all on hold with CPS benefits.
Oh, my God.
And it could take a good 20 minutes. You have a 45-minute lunch break. You might not actually get a hold of someone that day. And then the office is closed right around an hour after our school day ends.
Uh-huh.
So
a lot of time.
That is something that – you know, that is time when I could be grading papers and eating a lunch. I mean, that's what we do. We do all those things at once. We shouldn't have to. And you know, just all the red tape.
I'm sorry. All the red tape.
Yeah. I mean, I know people who've had like serious health conditions have to like, you know, I'm not going to rat them out, of course, but have to take a sick day to sit down and wade through all of that to actually like take care of it to pay their bills.
Right.
It's ridiculous. Like, you can't really do that and have a job and a family.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's really, really difficult to get there. Mm-hmm. So, Medicare for all, we need that like right now, immediately.
Yes. So
you support Bernie Sanders, did you say? What are some of the reasons that you support that guy?
Well, I mean, the main thing with Bernie Sanders is the fact that he's running his campaign as the organizer in chief. Mm-hmm. My fantasy right now is I don't even know if I should use the word fantasy. Like, what I'm trying to wrap my head around is like what it's going to look like when I'm fighting alongside the president against Capitol, as opposed to fighting the president and Capitol because they're on the same side.
Right.
I don't know what this is going to look like. I'm both very excited and very scared about it.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like we don't have a state playing the buffer between us and Capitol. And I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the idea of, you know, having more openness in government, being able to actually get things done and changed, having an imagination. One of the things that I've always loved about Bernie and his plans and his policies is that they come from a very human place. It's like whoever his policy people are, they sat down, they're like, okay, what do people need and how do we build out from there?
Yeah.
And when I listen to like Elizabeth Warren or any of the very wonkish types, it's always like, here's a policy. Now, how can we cram this to make sense in people's lives?
Right.
Like, we have this policy, the policy has an app. It has all these like, you know, bells and whistles and shit, bells and whistles and whatnot. And they don't actually solve the problem. And then we get blamed when these problems aren't solved.
Right. And to kind of like take it from a different, maybe take what you've said and maybe take it from a little bit of a different angle. Like you said that what Bernie's doing is he is kind of like appealing to people's like everyday concerns and worries. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the sort of Warren approach is sort of like, let's see if we can get the smartest people, you know, the same kind of like structures of the society. But mm-hmm. if you think good people or whatever that means, into those positions that where decisions get made, then it's going to work out for working people. And that doesn't necessarily follow because it doesn't matter what kind of a person you are. You're still in a system with the same incentive structure. But if you have a mm-hmm. large mass movement of people, then people are going to push no matter. I mean, these people are going to push for their interests. And when you have a broad coalition of people who have aligned interests, then you have something that's extremely powerful.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And like, it's very, you know, Warren's organizing and policy kind of models are very similar. She's like, one of the things that her campaign is good at is the grass tops type of organizing where they can go out to a bunch of nonprofits, talk to the executive directors, probably promise them things and get them excited about the campaign. And you know, she's the same thing with union leaders and things like that. What they're awful at is grassroots organizing, is actually like talking to the people individually and getting them excited about her style of politics. And you know, like you're saying, her policies, the way she goes about that are very similar too, like getting all the quote unquote best people in a room together and not necessarily getting a bunch of people in the room together who are impacted by policies.
Right. It's not led by the people that are the most affected, which is a problem.
Yeah.
Because that means that you have this distance between the people who are making the decisions and the people who it affects. And that's going to be that is an issue. Like, nobody knows the working conditions in a school more than mm-hmm. Nobody knows what their students need to learn more than a teacher. And then that's the example I'm giving because that's the one that I know the most right now.
And just broadly speaking, it just takes class completely out of the picture. When
yeah.
you have all of these doctors and scientists and, you know, consultants from D.C. all in a room together and none of the working people involved, they're not going to be solutions that are going to make capital at all uncomfortable.
Right.
Or, you know, the heads of business, like they're going to be happy. Like, those are the people that get served first. We get served after that.
Yeah.
And if, you know, if it's a happy accident, then it's good. I think ACA is a good example of this, where it's a policy that it's in, you know, chunks of it make sense and are decent, like yeah. extending the age of, you know, children being on the parents' insurance. I think that's a really good thing and has nothing to do with the rest of the program, mm-hmm. which is like a patchwork of things that the insurance companies were cool with.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's, you know, I think that's kind of the model we'll see more of with someone like Warren.
Yeah. And let's pause real quick for station ID. But I want to continue on this point. You listen to Good Morning Comrade, WHIVLP New Orleans, 102.3, Jeff Barawa and Kenzo Shibata. So one of the things, too, and I noticed this a lot, is that when like a lot of these charter school type organizations start kind of getting their hooks into an area, one of the approaches that they do is they would put kids out there to like say, well, this school that I'm at, or, you know, this school that I'm at is really great and we should have more like it, you know, this charter school. Mm-hmm. And they're going to like at least, you know, do that. And it's not even necessarily grass tops organized. It's more like an AstroTurf, right? And they're sort of like generating what seems to be like a grassroots mood. And if you're like countering that with the, you know, numbers from a professional, that nobody's going to listen to that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have entire communities pushing for, you know, public schools or community schools, that's an entirely different thing. That's mm-hmm. a lot more powerful. And I'm thinking, I have that on my mind because like my school is currently marked for closure. And
oh, really?
Yeah, they're moving a lot of. Well, recently, and I talked a little bit about this on the show. Last month at the school board meeting, the superintendent rolled out a plan. That's like it's an infrastructure plan, an efficiency plan, you know, like one of those. And part of the idea of it is to close 4 public schools and roll them into pre-K or kindergarten through 8. So it's one of those things. And then one of the school board members came up to me after because I, you know, got mad and ended up on the news. But he said he wanted to go to the portfolio model. And that basically means charter schools coming, you know. And I'm right next to New Orleans. I'm in Jefferson Parish. They have the portfolio model and they're 100% charter schools.
Yeah.
So it's like one of those brutal times where like I'm trying to rally the troops, but unfortunately a lot of there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of apprehension about engaging with this.
Yeah, I can imagine like there's a whole model that like it's almost like when they start to privatize schools, they open up a box and they have a whole kit that they enroll in. We saw that in Chicago, like the kit includes paid protesters because they can never seem to find enough people in the public to say close down this public school, so then they pay people from other communities to do it. That was a common thing in Chicago. And another thing you should want to look out for is space utilization. Like what they would do to close schools is they'd say, well, this school is underutilized because it's X amount of square feet with, you know, Y amount of kids, but they would measure non-instructional areas like, you know, teaching lounges and you know, hallways and things like that. So it was a way of like gaming it so schools would look underutilized.
Yeah, because they had this consulting group come in and do exactly that. They basically tested all these schools for capacity.
Uh-huh.
Have them like rated like on some kind of score that they never elaborated on what it was. It was just like, this one has a red, this one is a green, this one is a yellow, you know. They made it that simple. And next thing you know, well, the decisions that were made, we're going to close these schools, and they're going to be moving an elementary school to a middle school to one of these pre-K-8 situations where they don't have tiny little, you know, bathrooms for the pre-kindergartners or kindergartners or anything like that.
Oh geez.
Yeah, it's going to be a disaster. But we have an opportunity to fight it because there is a school board meeting on if you're listening right now in New Orleans, March 4th, come to 501 Manhattan and at 5:00 and help us fight this thing. Fight for our kids.
Yeah, definitely be there. Numbers like March 4th. That's an easy one to remember. It sounds like a sentence, guys. March 4th to the school board.
Yeah. March. Yeah, that's exactly right. March the 4th be with you or something. Oh yeah. So yeah, I guess last couple of minutes, you have a program as well that you host. It's a podcast. Would you like to give some people information about Class Time?
Oh sure, yeah. Check out Class Time with Kenzo Shibata. It's a podcast I started. Actually, I started it on Halloween because I wanted to record my friend Ambry and I talking about the strike. She was a first year teacher, and the idea was just to release that. And then I just decided to like expand it and continue putting out episodes. So it's a double entendre. You know, I talk a little bit about the classroom, but mainly it's about class politics. Mm-hmm. And I've had some interesting guests on, had Matt from Chapo on recently, Liza Featherstone, Leslie Lee III, really good episode we just put out, Ben Dixon, who just uncovered that audio of Bloomberg being racist about Stop and Frisk. I had him on to talk to him about that.
I think we're out to Ben, too, to kind of talk about it. But the Bloomberg thing is kind of ebbing. I mean, again, after Super Tuesday, we need to make sure that this is done.
Yes.
Until Super Tuesday, like we have to be making sure, because his plan seems to be get big wins there. But that was just unbelievable. It was just what he said in that video.
Yeah, he just laid it all out. There was no sugarcoating. There was no double speak. It was, he's a racist guy.
Yeah. Period. Period. The end.
And it's crazy because in some ways it's like, you know, he's almost the harsher version of Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. He still does like all the same stuff. He's even like, and like, what's up, New York? Stop. Get your billionaires out of everywhere. We don't want them. Okay. But, and your mayors too. Keep your mayors in New York, whatever. but like, I don't know. They're functionally, I mean, they have like different positions on things like guns or whatever. But like, can you imagine if you know, in the hell world that it would be if Michael Bloomberg got the nomination, like what a field day Donald Trump would have with that, you know, soda tax.
Oh, yeah.
Just imagine.
Soda tax and the mini mic stuff. Like, oh,
he's already going with the mini mic.
Yeah, it'll be awful. Uh-huh. I mean, the one thing I don't think that Bloomberg could win. If he does get the nomination, I think Trump's going to win. But if he were to win, I actually think Bloomberg is more dangerous because Trump is kind of a lazy oaf and he's dumb. But Bloomberg is extremely sharp and he will work overnight. You know, he'll work night and day to get his agenda enacted. And that's scary to me. You know, Mr. Stop and Frisk having, you know, access to the bomb and, you know, willing to like work to get the political capital to use it. No, thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he doesn't have to work to get the political capital. He just buys it. Like
that's true.
he just controls all of the mayors in the country. You know, he just owns them all. You know, he can just he can just bankroll whatever he wants. It's horrifying.
Oh yeah, really, we talk
about this on the show a lot too. I mean, it's just like one day I did like 3 hours talking about Bloomberg.
We had So, you know, we're doing research in my civics classes and all the candidates. And then when Bloomberg announced, we had to add him to we have like these posters up in the room of all of the information on them. And like, you know, one day the kid pulled up, they're like, oh, my God, this guy's worth $63 billion.
Yeah.
2 days later, we returned to the same project and someone goes, damn, Mr. Shibata, he just made $2 billion in 2 days. And we looked at it, $65 billion he's worth now.
Good Lord. Nobody should have that much money ever.
No one should.
Kind of that. Like, why? Well, what society? What is the need for that in society? I mean, all he's going to do with that money is bad stuff.
Yes.
All he's going to do with that money is bad stuff. I mean, even if you think that somebody might like, what do you like if you think that like they've earned it or whatever, which is obviously BS. But like, what do you think when you have that much money and the money is what drives the system that you like the society that you work in and live in, what do you think is going to happen there? He's going to use it to build that power and in whatever way he can. And we see that again. I mean, I'm going to harp on some education stuff, but I mean, he's been one of as mayor, he closed like 160 something schools and turned them into charter schools. And then he spent hundreds of millions of dollars on outsourcing that. He spent a ton of money in Louisiana for the state school board races and things like that. Him and you know, Bill Gates and Eli Broad and all those folks gallery.
Oh, the edupreneurs.
Oh my God. The Waiting for Superman crew.
Uh-huh.
Oh my God. It's disgusting. Disgusting. And they just go ahead.
If you sift through enough of the Aspen Institute tapes, you find so much stuff. Like we found in 2011 The head of this group called Stanford Children, which was a group bankrolled by all the people you just mentioned.
Yeah.
They came into town basically to try to bust us during the 2012 strike. And Jonah Edelman, who's the head of the Stanford Children at the time, he was at the Aspen Institute, and he just talked about, and he very blatantly was talking about how he basically bought off our state legislature by, you know, giving money to key politicians to get them to whittle down our bargaining rights. And one person that really pissed off was actually our the head of our house, Michael Madigan, who is just, I mean, he's like power. He is the power of Illinois. Uh-huh. He is the boss of Illinois. He didn't like the fact that this little punk was like talking about how he tricked him. So that kind of worked in our favor, because Stanford Children is kind of not, they can't get anything done in the state really anymore. But yeah, that was the spot where he's like, yeah, this is where I'm going to be free, where I'm around other billionaires, and we can talk about this stuff.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not even so sure like what the Aspen Institute is, other than like where the evil billionaires just like, it's like the Hall of Injustice or whatever. You
that's
know?
What it is.
Yeah, it's just like where the bad guys hang out and like where they plot and they make their schemes.
It's like Comic-Con, but for supervillains.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I guess I did interrupt your information about class time. Where can you get more information about that? Class time.
Oh. Well, if you check out on check me out on Twitter at KENZOSHIBATA at my name, Kenzo Shibata. You'll be able to find the link to it, and yeah, and hopefully you'll be tuning in. You can also search for our on all the other subscription services, the podcast cool. ones.
Great. Well, thanks a lot, Kenzo. Appreciate you coming on. Good morning, comrade. It's been great talking to you.
And, thanks for having me on, Jeff.
And you can come on anytime you want. Just say the word.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, man. Well, thanks. Right. Thank you.
Oh, no problem.